We are now on daylight savings time, and I think most of us do enjoy having the longer days. The summertime comes on, but the one thing that does present a challenge is that on this morning we need to set our clocks ahead, or we can wake up and find ourselves we're running behind and late for services, or sleeping in and not making it to services. So we really have to think ahead on that, and I appreciate all of you doing that this morning. We do have some who are sick, and we miss them, and we're concerned for Don Revolinsky, because Don and Mary were not able to leave on their trip this week. Don had heard some results from a test that prostate that he's going to be having a surgery coming up, and they're delaying their trip for that. So our prayers, our thoughts are with Don and Mary. This morning we would like to turn to Mark chapter 14, verse 32 through 42, and think about the incident where Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. This is a very profound, and it is a supernatural encounter that Jesus has here, or one that is perhaps defies our human comprehension, goes beyond what our ability is really to comprehend fully what happened here. I mentioned last week that the day that Jesus died, the 24 hours that changed the world, the Bible in the four gospel accounts give a great deal of attention to this one single day in the life of Jesus, and understandably so, because this was the greatest event of all time when Jesus died upon the cross. And the gospels present for us beginning the night before, because the Jewish time calendar began from sundown to sundown. And we noticed last Sunday that about 7 p.m. on that night, which was the night for the Jewish Passover, Jesus and his disciples met in the upper room and observed the Jewish Passover together in a room that was given to them or provided for them by some unknown disciple in the city of Jerusalem. During that, as they were observing the Passover, which was in action of remembrance of the exodus of God delivering the people after the plagues of Egypt, and the final plague being the Passover where the Egyptians' firstborn died, they remembered this every year. But during this feast, Jesus made the announcement to the disciples that one of them was going to betray him, referring to Judas Iscariot. And then, after that, Jesus introduced what is a new memorial, because he took bread and he said, "This is my body," and he took the cup and he said, "This is my blood of the new covenant." So he was introducing a new service. He was introducing a new memorial observance for the new covenant and the New Testament that we observe today as the Lord's Supper. And the disciples may not have fully understood that at the time. All of this took place for several hours during the night, from maybe 7 o'clock to almost 11 o'clock in the evening. We're going to pick up today at that point in the events that unfolded that day in the life of Jesus. And the city of Jerusalem, as they left from the upper room at about this time, late in the evening, and made their way out of the city of Jerusalem and to the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives was located on the east side of Jerusalem, about a half a mile. And it is a hill that is above the city of Jerusalem. We might make a comparison with, if you're in the downtown Seattle area, to, if you're familiar with Queen Anne, looking from somewhere down in the downtown area up towards Queen Anne. Might be a similar situation to being in Jerusalem and looking across to the Mount of Olives. So late that evening, Jesus and his disciples left from the city of Jerusalem and they went out to the Mount of Olives. As they were on that trip, several things happened. It says that, first of all, they sang a hymn as they were leaving. They, in verse 26 of Mark 14, when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. We are told by Jewish scholars, by Bible scholars, that during the Passover feast, well, it was the common tradition among the Jews, and still today, to sing the Psalms that in our Bible is Psalms 113 through 118. And this these Psalms are known as the Hallel by the Jews. And that means praise. Now, it was traditional that on the night of the Passover, the psalm that they would have most likely been singing was Psalm 118, the last of these Psalms. And as you look at these Psalms here in Psalm 118, it's a remarkable psalm because in this psalm is prophecies of Jesus and words that would have been very uplifting and encouraging to Jesus at this time and would be loaded with meaning for him. For example, in Psalm 118 and verse 5 and 6, said, "I called on the Lord in distress. The Lord answered me and set me in a broad place. The Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do to me? The Lord is my strength and song. He has become my salvation." Later in the same psalm, in verses 22 through 24, is an even more direct prophecy of Jesus that some of us are familiar with from, it's quoted in the New Testament, "The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone." This is referring to Jesus. How he was rejected by the Jews, but he became the chief cornerstone of God's building, of his temple, of his household. And it goes on to say, "This was the Lord's doing. It was marvelous in our eyes. This is the day the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it." Sometimes we sing a song today, "This is the day the Lord has made." And we sing about, it's a happy song. It's a song of rejoicing that God has given us this day. Whatever day it is that we are worshiping God. "This is the day the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it." But it's interesting to me to think that the night that Jesus was going to be crucified, and as that was on his mind, they sang this song, "This is the day the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it." I think that's amazing that they sang that particular song probably this evening as they were leaving from the upper room going out to the Mount of Olives. Now on the way there, it says that in verse 27 that Jesus told them to his disciples, and this would be 11 of the disciples because Judas is no longer there. He said, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you into Galilee." Now, Jesus was giving a warning to his disciples and several other things to exhort them. They needed to be diligent in their faith this night, because they were going to be put to the test. And he makes the statement here. He said, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night. For it is written," and he quotes this passage, "the shepherd, they will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered." But then he says, "After that, I will go before you into Galilee." So Jesus was warning his disciples, but he was also looking beyond that to after he was raised. What's he talking about? He's going to be raised from the dead. he's constantly referring them back that he is about to be crucified. And they still don't fully understand this, what's getting ready to happen. Whenever the disciples heard this, Peter spoke up first, but all of them echoed what Peter was saying and what he was thinking. Peter said, "Even if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be." Jesus said to him, "Assuredly, I say to you that today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." But he spoke more vehemently, Peter did, "If I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And they all said likewise. So all of the disciples didn't really believe what Jesus was saying, that they were going to be scattered, they were going to stumble, they were going to fall away this night. They didn't believe that. They didn't think it would ever happen that way. Yet Jesus told them, yes it is, it's going to happen. And we see a contrast, I believe, between the disciples, they're very overconfident of themselves, and the way Jesus is when he goes into the Garden of Gethsemane, that he is getting down on his knees praying to God that God will help him make it through this, what's coming. The other disciples think, "Oh, we won't never do this." Sometimes we are that way in our thinking, that we don't take to heart the temptations that we're going to be facing. We think nothing is going to faze us. We're strong. We can handle all of these things that are out in the world. And oftentimes we find out the hard way, as the disciples, that that temptation was stronger than I thought it was going to be. I didn't do so well in that particular situation. Jesus is always warning us, encouraging us, you need to have more strength. You need to realize temptation is strong. You're going to be put to the test. And if you're not careful, you can fail that test. God still loves you. And God, he said, "I will go before them into Galilee." He is still going to help them after this all happens, that they stumble and they fall away. Jesus is still going to love them. And there's still going to be things that he will do to restore them back to where they need to be. But in Mark 14, verse 32, this brings us now to about 11 p.m. of this night before he was crucified, that they arrived in the Garden of Gethsemane. Late at night, they came to a place which was named Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." Now, Gethsemane means an oil press. It's a garden with olive trees. And there are references of this in all four of the Gospels where it says that Jesus often frequently came here with his disciples. Which is maybe one reason that Judas knew where to find them later on that evening. But they came into the Garden of Gethsemane, quiet place, late in the evening, Jesus and the disciples. And Jesus is wanting to teach them the importance of praying. And he leaves eight of the disciples, and he takes Peter and James and John, and he goes further back into the garden. The indication is this is a large garden. Two things. One of them is that he leaves Peter and James and John, or leaves the other disciples, and goes further with the three. And then it says that he went further by himself, a stone's throw. And you know, you know how far you can throw a stone. That's quite a ways. This is a pretty large garden, in other words. And Jesus goes way back into the garden where he does most of his praying. But he was wanting to warn the disciples, and he's wanting to help teach them and prepare them. Jesus had more relied on Peter, James, and John. They were some of the first disciples. They were leaders among the apostles in the way of their maturity and other things, where Jesus had a close relationship with them. He did a lot of things with them that he didn't always do with the other 11 of the apostles. So he took them with him and he began to be troubled and deeply distressed. And then he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch." Sometimes it makes me think that Jesus did not want to show any weakness in front of the other 8 disciples, but that he had enough trust of Peter, James, and John that he would share some of his feelings with them. Because he needed to share how he was feeling, and he did that with Peter, James, and John. Sometimes we as parents, I know you can probably relate to this, is there are times that you have to be strong. Like if you are a parent and with your children, there are times in life that you may be very fearful. You may be struggling of something going on in your life. But with your children, what you want to project with them is you're strong. You're going to take care of them. So they're not worried. And that's the way Jesus was being. He was being very strong. But he did have these anxiety of what was about to happen. He's thinking about knowing that the cross is coming, and it's on his mind. It's heavy, weighing down upon him. So it says here that he began to be troubled and deeply distressed, and he was really struggling with these feelings that he was having. So he shared some of that with Peter, James, and John, and he asked them to stay here and be praying. But they fell asleep. And each time when he came back, they were sleeping. So he was really by himself through this period of time. And it was one of the greatest struggles of his life. Now, I don't fully understand it. I don't think anyone does. Just what was causing him to be so distressed as this describes that he was. It says in some of the wording that is given of Jesus that with great crying and tears, with crying out with tears, and that he was so distressed that it was like sweat as drops of blood coming out from his body. He was very distressed, in other words, about this. There were times that Jesus, before this, like when he went out in the wilderness with the 40-day temptation of Satan. And one of the things Satan tried to do, I believe, was to discourage Jesus or to prevent him from going to the cross. Satan did not really want Jesus to go to the cross because he understood what the effect would be, I believe. Several times Jesus talked about the cross and Peter said, "No, no, no, Lord, it will never happen." And he said, "Get behind me, Satan." In the wilderness, when Jesus was tempted, he took him up on the peak of the temple and on the mountain, and he said, "If you will bow down and worship me, I will give you all of these kingdoms of the world." You don't need to go to the cross. In other words, I believe that was some of what the battle here in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus, you don't need to go to the cross. You don't have to go through with this. There is a way to get out of it. And Jesus was convinced in his mind, no, he needed to go to the cross. I think he understood that. But it was weighing heavily upon him at the same time. Some people are bothered by this. That was Jesus here a lack of courage? A lack of faith on his part? when he prays this way, he said, "Father, let this cup pass from me." Is he trying to back out of going to the cross? Is he showing a weakness here? This troubles some people about if he is the Son of God, why does he go through this struggle the way he did at this time? We don't fully understand it. There's another theory that is very popular. Many people believe this is what was happening, is that in Psalm 22, where it talks about, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? That Jesus knew that when he was going to go to the cross, God was going to separate himself from Jesus and turn his back away from Jesus. And that terrified him, that his Father was going to be turning away from him while he died on the cross. Personally, I don't think that's what the Bible teaches. That God turned his back on Jesus. I don't believe he did. I believe that Jesus understood that he was carrying the burden of sin, and that he was going in the place to suffer the penalty of sin for the whole world. But God was with him in this, I'm convinced, and did not turn his back away from his Son, as many theologians believe the Bible is why Jesus was so troubled here at this time. But this was a struggle unlike anything we ever will go through. Just understand that. That you and I will never go through a struggle like what Jesus went through here. When we think about our struggle with sin, our struggle with sin is that in our weakness as human beings, we struggle because we are tempted to commit sin. That's the struggle that we go through. But Jesus, he never sinned in his life. He was tempted in all ways, yet without sin. He was holy. He was pure. Completely without sin. And in his entire life, he has been a holy servant of God, the Son of God. Now he was going to be placed where the sins of the world would be. He would be bearing those sins. He's never been in that position before. Just think about that. It's hard for us to even fathom what that would be like. For the sinless Son of God to take upon the weight of the sins of the world as if he was the one that committed those sins. It's so outside of his nature. He would not commit sin. He would never have anything to do with sin. And yet he was going to be paying the penalty for the sins of mankind. Perhaps that is why he struggled so much to make that commitment that yes, he needed to go through with this. In Luke 22, verse 43 and 44, it said that an angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Then his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. So it was a great struggle that Jesus went through here. And that's the first thing that we notice here in this text. The second point of the lesson this morning, a passionate petition that Jesus makes here at this time. And this is the petition. He went a little further and fell on the ground and prayed, if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will. Jesus called upon his Father and Father, all things are possible with you. You are God. You're all powerful. If it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Is there any other way that your plan can be carried out without my having to do this, which I so dread doing, taking upon and being in the place of sin. There, yes, there's all the physical suffering. But I believe it was more the anguish of the sin that was on Jesus' mind. But if it were possible, let this hour pass from Him. You know, it was not possible in the God, in the Father's will. There was no other way. There was no other way for man to be saved but through the shedding of blood of Jesus. In Hebrews 9 and verse 22, it says, without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. And it could not be the blood of bulls and goats. So how was man going to be saved? If Jesus did not go to the cross, there was no other way. He said, if it is possible, let this pass. It's not possible. Not my will, but your will be done. So Jesus prayed this prayer three times. What was this cup that Jesus referred to? Take this cup away from me. I believe it was the cup of God's wrath. That God would pour out His wrath upon sin. And that cup is referred to in the Old Testament, in the book of Psalms, in Psalm 75 and verse 8. It's referred to in the book of Isaiah, in the book of Jeremiah. There are a number of the prophets that talk about the cup of God. In Psalm 75 in verse 8, for in the hand of the Lord there is a cup, and the wine is red. It is fully mixed, and He pours it out. Surely its dregs shall all the wicked of the earth drink and drain down. This was the wrath of God. And Jesus was going to drink that cup. He had to drink this cup in order for the sins of man to have any hope of forgiveness. Earlier in Matthew chapter 22, when the mother of James and John came, and she asked if her sons could sit on the right hand and the left hand in the kingdom. And Jesus said to them, you do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink? This was the cup of God's wrath and His judgment against sin. And in John 18:11, Jesus, when He was standing before Pilate, He said, the cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it? He was determined and knew that He must drink this cup. So there was a passionate petition that was given by Jesus. But at the end of it, He said, not my will, but your will be done. Then there is an affectionate exhortation that He goes back and He sees the disciples sleeping several times. He came and found them sleeping, and He said to Peter, Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit is indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. I think it's interesting that He goes back to the first name of Peter when He first met him, Simon. Simon, are you sleeping? So He exhorted them that, again, they needed to be awake. But they were so sleepy and so tired. It was late at night. And they could not stay awake. So Jesus, in an affectionate way, exhorted them, watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. This is an exhortation that we're given in the prayer that Jesus teaches His disciples in Matthew chapter 6. It says, do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. And in 1 Peter 5 and verse 8, be sober, be vigilant. Your adversary, the devil, is a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour. We're warned many times in the Bible not be overconfident that your good intentions, they are fine, but the temptations are very strong. And do not be like the disciples that, oh, we will never, this will never happen to us. We will never deny you, Lord. We're strong. We need to realize none of us are that strong that we think we are. We need the help of God. And Jesus was approaching it in the proper way here in the garden, late during the night. We see the fourth thought of this, the triumphant submission of Jesus. Verse 36, and he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will. And verse 41, then he came the third time and said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? It is enough. The hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. Jesus knew by this time that Judas was on his way, leading this band of soldiers, coming, approaching the garden, coming to arrest him. Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of sinners. That was a troubling thought. That he is sinless. He has come to earth. He has performed miracles. He has shown love to all. He's about to be betrayed into the hands of sinners. What are they going to do with him? But he's ready now to go and meet this, what is about to happen. How did Jesus face this time? Well, when Judas arrives with the soldiers, Jesus is totally composed. He is totally ready. He doesn't show any weakness. He doesn't try to take the disciples and run off in the back of the other direction to get away. He goes out to face them. And how did he come to have this courage and this strength? It was through these prayers that he prayed. In Hebrews 5 and verse 7, it says that who in the days of his flesh, when he offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death and was heard because of his godly fear, though he was a son, yet learned he obedience through by the things which he suffered. It's interesting that it says here that God was able to save him from death, and that God heard his prayer. How did God hear his prayer and save him from death? Because he did die. God did not stop him from going to the cross. What God did was raise him from the dead. After this happened, he saved him from death through the resurrection, not through avoidance of the cross. And through his crying and tears, God heard his prayer because of his godly fear. And then he was determined through his obedience to submit to the will of God, which is what he did. In Psalm 16 and verse 10, the psalmist said, for you will not leave my soul in Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. Speaking about the resurrection, Jesus believed that God would raise him from the dead. And in Romans 1, 3 and 4, Paul said that concerning the gospel, concerning his Son Jesus Christ, our Lord, who was born of the seed of David according to the flesh and declared to be the Son of God with power, according to the Spirit of holiness, by the resurrection from the dead. So it was through the resurrection that God saved Jesus from death. It seems almost a contradiction when you read that passage. But God made it very clear. There is no other way for the eternal plan than for Jesus to go to the cross. But he saved him from death because Jesus entrusted that if he went to the cross, God would raise him from the dead. Jesus was now ready, so he went out to face the soldiers and Judas. And Judas came and kissed him and betrayed him. And Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that would come upon him, went forward and said to them, "Whom are you seeking?" And they answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus said, "I am he." And Judas, who betrayed him, also stood with them. Now when he said this to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Then he asked them again, "Whom are you seeking?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus answered and said, "I told you that I am he. Therefore, if you seek me, let these go their way." See the confidence of Jesus, the courage, how strong he is. We think, he went into the garden and he was so weak. He's struggling with those thoughts about the coming of the cross. We don't see that at all. Now that he comes out here, he's very strong. God has answered his prayer. He has come out of that temptation. And whatever it was, if Satan was trying to put the thought in his mind, "Jesus, you don't really need to go to the cross. You can avoid the cross. It's not necessary to die this way." Jesus realized it's the only way, and he is going to go through with it, that the scriptures might be fulfilled. Then Jesus answered and said, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me? I was daily with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me, but the scriptures must be fulfilled." When that happened, then they all forsook him and fled, meaning all the disciples. Now a certain young man followed him, having a linen cloth thrown around his naked body, and the young men had laid hold of him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. A lot of people feel that was Mark, John Mark, who wrote the Gospel of Mark, that he was there and he became frightened and he fled away during the night. But all the disciples fled Jesus at this point. It left him all by himself to go out with the soldiers and go through the trials and the next day go to the cross. He understood what he was going to have to do. And Jesus had the courage and the love and the grace to carry out that plan of God. We'll never understand, we'll never comprehend how much that affected him that night. How strong of a anxiety came upon him, how deeply troubled he was. But the encouragement is, he got down on his knees with God on the ground and he prayed through that temptation and he came out of that victorious. And because of that, we're able to look back and be aware that our sins were laid upon him and the penalty was fully paid, that we will not have to pay that penalty ourselves in eternity. We're going to stand and sing the invitation song that has been selected. Pray that this lesson of Jesus is encouraging to us. To me, there's many Christians today that have a very superficial knowledge of Jesus, what Jesus really did for us. Don't really understand it very well. Take it maybe lightly. Something very deep and profound that was happening there that night. And this was the greatest events of all history unfolding. Let's stand and sing the invitation song. And if you're subject in any way to Jesus, we invite you to come as we stand and sing.
714. when we walk with the Lord
in the light of